tested for a legal ID. Way hey, 90.1. The DJ said WUSB. Way hey, 90.1. They start each day with the rising sun. Way hey, 90.1. And don't ever finish till after day is done. Way hey, 90.1. So if you want good music to hear. Way hey, 90.1. There's a station in Stony Brook you ought to hear. Way hey, 90.1. So if you like the sounds, do take a look. Way hey, 90.1. At WUSB Stony Brook. Hey, hey, hey.
And this is WUSB Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock time for Off the Wall. Good Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, I'm here. What's up?
Oh, you know what's up. We've only been glued to the TV all day with this insane trial that's going on.
Yeah, it's really powerful.
Don't get me wrong, the trial is very, very necessary, but the things people are saying in the trial are insane. The defense specifically. It's disturbing. Of course, we're talking about the trial of the policeman who murdered George Floyd last year. You can tell I've already reached my conclusion, but the evidence is incontrovertible, as Pink Floyd would say. You know, you have numerous video angles. You have all kinds of sworn testimony, and it's disturbing but necessary to watch this. And we just saw the EMT give some very riveting testimony, and then she was admonished by the judge for being too emotional. I really thought he was a bit of a prick, if you pardon my language. Basically mansplaining down to her how to behave in court. I thought her testimony was right on what needed to be said. I thought the defense attorney was being a real jerk to her, basically saying, how would you feel if people were yelling at you while you were trying to put out a fire, or some ridiculous scenarios like that.
We're talking about false comparisons.
We're talking about a man's life here. We're talking about somebody being murdered in front of a crowd of people. And you know, this isn't said enough, but the African-American community in this country is so incredibly restrained. I mean, the right course of action, in my opinion, when you see somebody slowly killing someone like that, you charge the bastards. You take over. You defeat them. And of course, you know, that's my naive view of how justice works. But when you're a person of color in this country, you know that doesn't work. That only leads to more misery. And you have to sit back and be patient and allow them to get away with unspeakable atrocities. Not just murder, but just every single day what you have to live through. Being talked down to, being subjected to searches based on nothing but your color, your race. But man, you know, I see what those people did, what those cops did to that guy, and it fills me with anger. And it's you know, the American people only seem to be able to frame this. I'm talking about the mainstream, mostly white Americans. They seem to only be able to frame this as rioting mobs. You know, that is what they see, people who are upset by what happened to George Floyd. That's how they portray them. It's completely inaccurate and offensive on its own. When what they should be doing is looking at what these armed people with guns are doing to communities throughout the country. And when people march in the streets and say Black Lives Matter, you don't come back and say, oh, but Blue Lives Matter too. You know, imagine if your kid got the crap beaten out of him in school, okay, by some other kid who had more on his side. Maybe he was bigger, maybe he was stronger, who knows. And the principal called you all into their office, and her conclusion after, you know, your kid bloodied and limping, the other kid smirking, hey, we're all valuable kids. We're all wonderful people. Let's embrace each other. I actually had something like this happen to me in first grade, where some kid, he was actually smaller than me, but he still, you know, he beat me up pretty good. And I don't know what happened, but I think it was the principal, might have been the teacher. Just throughout the course of yelling at this kid, it turned into yelling at both of us. Then it turned into just yelling at me. And in the end, I had to apologize to him. I never understood that. It was first grade, so my memory might be a bit cloudy, but I know I was the one that got hurt, and he was the one that didn't get hurt, and yet somehow it was my fault. But imagine that. Imagine that kind of injustice. That is what, when you go out there and say Blue Lives Matter or All Lives Matter, you're ignoring. You're ignoring the issue here, which is that Black people are being murdered as if their lives don't matter. That's why the phrase is relevant. And when you come back with something ridiculously offensive that just ignores that and says, oh, but we're all equal, you are ignoring what actually has happened to lead to this. And then that becomes the conversation. So that's what the country's going through right now. Day two of this trial. How long is this trial going to go on for? Weeks?
At least 2 weeks, I think.
Wow.
It's looking like. It's just the way they're going through and the amount of witnesses, I think a dozen people. And they've synchronized a lot of the videos, so you're looking at how everyone assembled and was bearing witness to this. I think there's a lot of passion, and tempering some of that and just getting straight answers from the witnesses is sort of worthwhile. I don't get why the judge was quite so angry, because it's not surprising that she, Miss Hansen, was upset, and just the despicable line of questioning, impugning basically her judgment or motives, or that she wasn't using training by the mere fact that she should ought to have assumed emergency response was on the way, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a couple different things happening simultaneously. It's kind of hard to convey, especially if you're also caught up in the emotion of it as a witness, because her point was there was a couple things she was trying to point out about the response time, which in her mind rationalized that nuance of the situation. But the prosecution or defense for Officer Chauvin is trying to make it seem as though she should have assumed the situation was under control. But the fine line there, I think, is that in all her training, there's no criteria for police officers murdering someone in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she could justifiably say she was not prepared to address that situation. And so she was trying everything she could along with her training, but everything she could think of as any human would, and as many others in that witness group were simultaneously trying everything they could.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really buy this argument that she ought to have known better, which is actually something Officer Tao, the person who was, quote, controlling the scene, what he remarked to her when she came in and said, I'm a firefighter, I'm trained, you know, let me have access. She was trying to convince them of her credentials so that she could gain access and control the medical part of the situation.
Right.
And I just found little angles like that, and I think a lot of the commentary pundits, they're going to go in on a lot of how those characterizations are actually a little bit weaker than they seem in the questioning. But in the questioning, it's hard to maintain and not really say what you want to say to the defense.
These are human beings. They're not, I mean, lawyers are human beings too, I know. But lawyers are trained on how to answer a question in court. I'll give you an example. Kyle, do you have the time?
Yes.
Would you give me the time?
Yes.
What's the goddamn time? Actually, you don't know the time, so you lied on court.
I'd have to look.
You lied on the stand there because you didn't know. But actually, what Kyle did was completely correct. That is how you're supposed to answer a question in court. Do you have the time? Yes. Don't give me the time. Just tell me, yes, you have the time. Would you give me the time? Yes, I'd give you the time. But still, I haven't asked for the time yet. And then when I finally ask you for the time, that's when you're supposed to give me the time, assuming you're not lying and you didn't know the time the whole time.
It's a tough thing to do. They've also got other back and forth where they want to get a transcription, and the line of questioning is so obvious, and a lot of the answers are just affirmative acknowledgement, that it becomes so conversational, they're overlapping. So there's some of that, but it's more the problem with wanting to ad lib a little bit, but it's... You can empathize as to where so many witnesses with such overwhelming evidence, where they're going mentally. That
but it's also, you know, the people asking them the question, when you only answer it the way they want you to, you're serving them. And I think as a witness, you should be allowed a little bit of leeway as far as expressing yourself and answering the question to your satisfaction. And if the judge doesn't like that, you know, he can gently admonish you and say, just answer the question. You don't have to lecture them afterwards and make them feel like crap.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt. It's hard to convey that it doesn't hurt to answer it with the same narrow pinhole view that the defense wants to ask their question through. Mm-hmm. The scope of their question is like a pinhole of as far as looking at the entirety of it. And you kind of, even though you don't want to answer one way, even in that line of questioning, it still benefits you to answer in with the dryness that the question deserves and was delivered to you in, even though it's completely understandable why you might why that might not be your first impulse. The point is, like, they're looking at it through a pinhole. Just give them that answer, but the best I think you could do is give the answer that and qualify it through as fine a filter in some way. And in other words, give the right answer, but also qualify it through the same kind of filtering that they're doing with the question. Because it really sets you up, right?
I just think you're asking people to come in from their daily lives into court and play by your rules. I think if you're going to be asking people what they saw, you have to listen to their words. You have to listen to the way they speak. You have to listen to the way they answer the question and take out of that what you will. But don't try and shape them into something that they're not. And to expect people to only answer in a certain way, not show any emotion, that's wrong. I've always felt that's wrong.
And even if they don't like the way you answer it, I would say is hardly combative.
Hey, yeah, it's
like,
tough.
You're still answering the question.
Yeah.
So you're giving more information. Somehow that's combative. I don't know. I don't really find that.
So you don't like the way they answer it. I don't like the fact this is happening in the first place. Nobody's happy. You know, you're a grown-up lawyer. Deal with it. Anyway, so this trial's going to be going on for a while. It's going to be pretty combative, but I think there's only one outcome.
I'm gripped by the plainness, the just complete like humble place a lot of the witnesses come from, and it kills me mm-hmm. in how just every day their stories and how jarring it must be by contrast what they're recounting was compared to just the everyday, like going to work, working at a service station. That I think was really a gripping realization to hear them and in that authentic way.
Yeah.
Like they're really just telling you what happened in their life one day.
Their nobility, their courage, you know, their value of human life. These are things to be celebrated. And it's all on display as they're standing up against the system to tell the truth, backed up by video evidence. It's a really almost impossible case for the defense to win. And boy, I sure hope the justice system doesn't fail in this case. It would be a real tragedy if it did. Anyway, that's what's going on right now. We're here for an hour or less of an hour to talk about various things going on. I just wanted to mention WUSB is in the midst of its spring fundraiser. Spring has just begun, and so is our fundraiser. And you can call 631-632-6901 and pledge whatever you feel like pledging, whether it's a set amount, whether it's a monthly amount, if you wish to join the 90.1 club or the 107.3 club, those are our two frequencies, you'll get all kinds of amazing WUSB paraphernalia in exchange for that, plus our undying thanks. Or you can go directly to our donor registration form online. I've got a special URL, tinyurl.com/helpWUSB. Yeah, as simple as that, tinyurl.com/helpWUSB. That takes you to the USB donor registration form. where you can actually enter your pledge online. So that's pretty awesome.
And any amount really makes such a huge impact here. We're just a small community station. We're mostly volunteers here. There's just a few operational staff that are paid. Everyone
There's
else here.
One operational staff that's paid.
That's right. And everyone else is either a student or a community member. And we make this crazy little place the magical place it is and the renowned place it is, because there are listeners everywhere that listen to this show, that listen to many different shows. They are all over the planet, all over the universe, I would venture to say. And they make this place great. And they respond to listeners like you. And in some cases, they listen, get feedback on the air at shows. Here, we ask for your phone calls occasionally. We read your letters on the air. We really like that interaction and incorporating the stories and the ideas of our listenership. And in exchange, every now and then, we ask for your help. So please give us a call, 631-632-6901. A friendly member of WUSB will answer and take down your information and ask for a special gift.
And if a friendly member of WUSB does not answer, it's probably because they're answering another call, and you'll be prompted to leave a message, and they can call you back, and they'll be just as friendly. And they'll take your information, or you can go to that tinyurl.com/helpwusb form and fill it out. It's simple, and it's very gratifying, because keeping WUSB on the air is something that we have been doing since 1977, when we first signed on June 27th. Yeah, and what a history we have, and what a future ahead of us if we all join together. Coming through for us in that regard, and we'll do our best to bring you all kinds of interesting information.
And if you've already pledged, remind a friend, tell a neighbor, let them know it's Radiothon. It's a spring tradition here. The quicker and the more donations that come in, the faster we'll be able to resume our regular programming and give you more episodes of the Off the Wall radio show.
On the air since 2003, by the way, which is incredible. That's how I know what's been happening in the world. I just look back at our own shows. They're all online.
It's a great record
of
the time.
We have a full library, 2600.com/off the wall. We keep all our radio shows archived there. And and this is only 1 hour, 1 hour of the entire week. There's so many different radio programs that you can hear on WUSB. Maybe the person that you're going to recommend calls us has never heard of WUSB. Maybe you can turn them on to this amazing radio station where all kinds of different music are played and all sorts of perspectives are explored. We have sports, we have news, we have local artists, we have public affairs of all sorts. I can't think of a specific type of music that is not played here. You know, I'd like to see, okay, I guess, you know, Mongolian throat singing doesn't have a regular show, but it could. It could. If somebody came up and said, I'd like to do a show on Mongolian throat singing and I won't just play the same song every week, odds are we'd put them on the air and see what they got. You know, there are all kinds. I've learned so much. I went to college at Stony Brook, and I learned so much about alternative music through WUSB and different cultures. And I like to think our listeners are taking that same journey, young and old, that we're all opening ourselves up to something different. And that's the magic of it. And we're the only station of our kind on Long Island, which is sad but true. Yeah, there aren't stations like this. They're few and far between. We don't make money, you know? It's not profitable.
But we get to decide what our format is as we go along. And that is true freedom. We have a really varied mix of music as well as other shows. And by having that freedom, we get to say and do things that are unusual, that are not heard much else on the radio spectrum. And it's a unique thing that this is a work in progress. There's additional shows that haven't even been thought of yet.
That's
but
right.
But because this resource is here, because you're supporting this kind of radio, those things can come into existence, and we'll be benefiting from that kind of creativity and immersing ourselves in just the imagination of radio. The really cool thing is those stories, those things can just be an idea. They can come from just a pure moment of joy, mm-hmm. something fun. A whole theme for a show could be happiness. Yeah, imagine that.
I've pledged after hearing a song that I liked. This song made me feel good. You know what? I'm gonna pledge $50 to this show because, wow, they made me feel good.
That's right. Or you can create a story that is so incredibly intricate and detailed that takes you mm-hmm. all over the place. We even air on Destinies. We have science fiction shows where there's old radio programming.
Every Friday night.
You get to be taken away into the supernatural or super heroic or super galactic. Who knows? But that is something that we want to foster. We want to share that history, but also invite people to create their own new stuff. We could have radio dramas all about campus if we wanted to. That is freeform radio, and that's what community radio offers in your neighborhood.
631-632-6901. That's the phone number to call to pledge to WUSB. And keep 90.1 and 107.3 broadcasting 24/7. Yeah, I know the Sea Shanty before said that we finish after the day is done, but we don't finish anymore. We just keep going. We used to sign off every day at 2:30. Everything used to sign off. Do you remember that? TV stations used to stop broadcasting at a certain time and play the national anthem. Even HBO signed off. Well, there was no HBO before that. So, yeah, things have changed, and we've changed with them. So your pledge is an investment in our future that will be there for whatever comes next.
Yeah, if you're there for us, we will be there for you. That comfort, that place you can return to and keep on in the corner of your house while you're going about your life. We want to be there with our listeners and invite more discussion.
631-632-6901 or tinyurl.com/helpwusb if you want to pledge directly into our form that's sitting there on the net. And you can write to us. You can email us, otw@2600.com. All right. You know, I had a bit of a tantrum last week. You remember this? I was upset that New York State had not been moving fast enough on legalizing marijuana. I'm happy to say, and I think this confirms that the authorities in New York State listened to the show, because literally the next day they said, okay, sorry, got distracted. Here it is. We're going to go ahead with this. And as I speak right now, it's being debated, but it's only a formality. It's going to a House vote, I believe, or a floor vote today. And it's going to happen. It's actually going to happen. It's being signed this week. So, okay. You upset me a little bit by you know, taking so long. Doesn't matter. You're getting it done. That's what's important. Marijuana will be legalized in this state. And it'll be legalized in a way that I think makes sense. I didn't realize that Washington, where you're from, Kyle, had so many restrictions. You can't grow your own plants.
That's true.
You can't have, I guess, what the equivalent of a bar where you can smoke in that bar.
That's right.
New York will have both of those. You can grow up to 12 plants per household, and there'll be, what do they call them, bud bars or something? Or
well, I think they're going to take many forms, and I think regionally they're going to be different in different parts of the country, as places do. They have different cultures around nightlife, around, of course, zoning is a big deal with retail mm-hmm. cannabis and the details that the New York State Health Department has concerned itself with will be formed and hashed out, of course, in the coming months. So as we shape this for the area, those kinds of things will be uniquely New York. It may make sense in certain places to have different structures. I don't know. Maybe it's like around a coffee place, for example, or mm-hmm. around different entertainment attractions, or even natural areas. Maybe they, who knows? I think it's up to the imagination, and it is yet to be seen. But that's really exciting in and of itself, in contrast to places like Washington, where it's like, okay, yeah, you can get this substance, but you have to have a home. You have to be able to do it in private, and so on and so forth, which is fine. But a lot of people have families. They have pets. They're, you know, parents. They're in a roommate situation, perhaps with someone that that is tested or has a specific occupation where cannabis is not ideal in their, you know, lifestyle. So that would be a scenario that this recreational, these bars or wherever, whatever form they take, that would help those situations, which are completely valid scenarios that just don't really sync well with the rules in Washington. The other thing in New York that is exciting is you can possess up to 3 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. That is almost a QP or a quarter pound of cannabis. And it's 3/4 of that. So that's an incredible achievement. In Washington, you can only have about 1 ounce. And in the decriminalization in New York City was around 25 grams, which is just under an ounce. So this 3 ounce allowance is just really generous and completely reasonable, I think, and manageable. I think that's a good, for adults, absolutely a great way to handle it. Responsible adults that are choosing this.
And when you consider there are at least 14 other states where it's legal, recreational, and it's working. When we went to Massachusetts to check it out there, it was done incredibly professionally. It makes things safer. And how it makes things safer, when you're buying marijuana legally, you're not buying it illegally, because, you know, one way or another, you're going to get your hands on it if you want it. And the guy in the store is not going to also be selling cocaine, you know, whereas the guy in the corner that you're meeting up with just might. It's the drug itself is not a gateway drug, but the social climate that you're forced into to get the drug is, or can be. And that's something that a lot of do-gooders fail to see when they say, oh my God, there's going to be a pot everywhere. Well, guess what? That guy in the corner is going to sell to your kid in junior high school. The people in the store will not. The people in the store will put the people on the corner out of business. They will, because there'll be nothing in it for them. Yeah, it might be a little bit more expensive, but the quality would be better. I mean, you found quality to be much better in the actual brick and mortar places, right?
It is a lot better. The selection.
Selection, certainly.
By and large, is much better. The kinds of specific products you can get, specifically concentrates, I think the availability and the concentrates and the refined products like waxes and keefs and hash, of course, bubble hash, those are all much more pure and you just cannot find that on the street as much as you can like whole flour. And of course the flour that a lot of those products are derived from meet strict standards and tests.
Exactly.
Are not full of chemicals in the same ways. They're cured and manicured appropriately.
On the street, there are no standards. There's nobody looking over their shoulder to make sure they're not poisoning you. This makes it so much safer. You know, you might not approve, but it's reality. People don't approve of drinking too. And marijuana is much, much safer than alcohol. It's been proven over and over again. Doesn't cause violence. The concern over driving is overblown, and there are all sorts of ways of addressing that as well. I'm seeing pushback. Of course, you always see pushback. In the past, many Democrats have delayed this or tried to prevent it, And I think those days are finally over. And I just hope, that here on Long Island, both in Nassau County and Suffolk County, specifically since we're in Suffolk County, that our county executive Steve Ballone does not fall into the trap of saying, yeah, we're not ready for it yet because all these people are concerned about their kids. It's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with the kids. The kids are safer now if it's legal here and if people are able to get it through a legal means. And it's inevitable. It's inevitable. Plus the tax advantages are phenomenal as well. So this won't be good if counties start saying, okay, but not here, and you still have to travel 400 miles to buy something. That would really defeat the whole purpose.
Those kind of patchwork solutions themselves, I think, diminish the market, as it were, because they narrow the amount of retail and overall tax base or tax revenue that you can generate, but also it limits the overall quantity and takes a lot longer for a good market to be established. Now, even specifically the quality question, like even if the quality is less or it's still emerging or, you know, kinks are being worked out, I think for all those reasons you mentioned, it's still worth it to support the legal models. If the black market has, you know, there's better quality or more small grow ops that are really specializing and you know, a lot of connoisseurs and stuff, it's there, but it's fewer and far between. The danger, I think, and a trade-off, I think, is bringing in established growers or having that emerge. It takes a little while, so there will be instances where there's a lot of stuff that's grown hydroponically or in a commercial way, but again, those advantages still are, I think, worth it. At least you're creating some kind of tax revenue. At least there's a quality level where you're not making people sick. It's worth it to at least get established, and maybe in the short term, there's still, you know, really good strains on the black market. It's still there. Over time, as you allow it to mature, it just becomes less feasible. So there's growing pains along with it, but it's really, really encouraging as it stands now.
This is a positive development. Whether or not you see it, it is a step forward. It's inevitable. Let us embrace it. Let's see where it goes. And take advantage of all the good things, the health benefits, the job benefits, the tax benefits.
My first reaction to this was just simply that we are awash in trauma as humanity, as a country, as a region, as a in all ways. And this, I think, is a huge, huge step to healing. And I think we need to look at it that way.
Okay, other good news. Biden administration Monday released details of a multi-pronged effort to jumpstart the nation's offshore wind industry, including plans to auction off long-anticipated wind energy areas off Long Island that encompass waters off the Hamptons. Yeah, wind turbines. Another positive step forward.
Really big ones, too. Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's being hailed by people everywhere. Southampton Town Supervisor Jay Schneiderman says that area is too close to shore, in my opinion, and should not be considered. It appears to be 15 miles out in the ocean. That would make it very easy to see the large turbines. These utilities need to be... Wait, Schneiderman, what are you doing here? What are you saying? Look, it's a nice thing to see, wind turbines. You know, oh my God, why do people think that a wind turbine 15 miles away from shore is somehow going to negatively affect their land? I don't get that. I would love to see a wind turbine in the distance.
And if it was an oil rig, would he be as quiet? I really doubt it.
What's wrong with seeing the large turbine? I don't understand why. Look, you can see a smokestack. Are you objecting to that? How about every time some forest is destroyed to build another housing development with townhouses or retirement communities or whatever? Are you upset by that? You know, because the tree's no longer there. You can't look at the trees anymore. You're looking at somebody's front door. Come on. Why do we put these ridiculous standards in place just for the things that are moving us forward in particular ways? Yeah. it's visible. You can see a wind turbine if you're coming up close to it. 15 miles away, it's pretty far away. I don't think you'd have to use binoculars to see it.
But how many other things do we gather and let a decision hinge, a municipal decision hinge on the aesthetics of something? I really feel like the visual appeal is one of the last considerations for a lot of projects, especially critical infrastructure and energy. What pipeline is painted the right color? You know, mm-hmm. How often do we get to weigh in on the proper shade for, you know, painting pipelines or whatever other equivalent infrastructure?
I'm sick to my stomach, said Bonnie Brady, executive director of the Long Island Commercial Fishing Association. These are grounds that guys fish. That's how they feed their families and the nation. All right, Bonnie. Look, I'm sympathetic. I really am. But the ocean is huge. It really is. And if the fish, you know, aren't there, they'll be someplace else. I don't understand how a wind turbine means that people can't fish. This doesn't make any sense to me. The ocean is so big, and there are lots and lots of fish. You know, you guys just have to adjust your business model so you don't overfish, so you don't deplete the supply. I think that's a bigger problem. But how does the placement of winter? I mean, people complain about everything you can possibly imagine. The sound of wind turbines, wind gives you cancer, our last president said. Ridiculous things like this. Look, it's a positive step forward. Deal with it. Gordian Rack, executive director of Renewable Energy Long Island, which is an East Hampton green energy proponent who strongly supports wind energy, but has argued against putting them offshore of the Hamptons. Boy. Why? Applauded the broader announcement and addition of new areas off Long Island, calling it a good day for renewable energy. What they've done here is a compromise. It's far off the coast, and it shouldn't be a big problem. Why would it be a problem at all? You know, you could put the things 100 feet off the shore. I wouldn't have a problem with it. Okay, other people might. But 15 miles away or in the distance, we're just looking for problems. This solves so many problems. It's green energy. It's not unattractive. It's certainly better than having barges and smokestacks and all the other things that we just accept. All right, let's try for a positive statement here. Mariah Dignan, a Long Island organizer for a labor group, Climate Jobs New York, called Biden's announcement a crucial step forward for New York. With these new wind energy areas off Long Island's coast, we're at the center of the emerging offshore wind industry. We must make sure these projects continue to move forward and ensure the once-in-a-generation opportunity creates family-sustaining union jobs for New Yorkers. And other people like it as well. So don't listen to the naysayers. These are good things. These are positive steps forward. And we need to do this.
Also, consider that it's a bit of a pilot or a demonstration, or it's an extension of pilots and demonstrations that have been done. And the more we diversify, the more examples of diversification in these systems, the more feasibility and the more appropriate builds there will be and designs in the future for other areas. And once a lot of this stuff is in place, you can modernize and create a system that's more and more fully integrated so that you can balance in various situations and be a lot more agile in the future with your energy needs. So this should be really something we're looking at as a foundation for the kinds of things we're going to need to see in the future.
Some other good news that people will try to convince you is not good news. Real world evidence shows the COVID-19 vaccines really work. Yeah, they've been out for a while now, and healthcare professionals who are exposed to the disease on a regular basis are doing much better. And the infection rate is minimal, if it existent at all, and people aren't getting sick, and that is important. I got my second dose last week, and one day of arm pain, a little bit of fatigue, and now I feel great. So get that vaccine. I know it opened up today to everybody 30 plus in New York, so it got really hard to get appointments. That website, you know, with the captures where you have to identify traffic lights and hills and things like that, it is such a pain. But give it some time. in a week or so, I think it'll be easier to navigate. Figure getting an appointment sometime in May at this point. Or go to other sites, go to your drugstores, look into those possibilities.
And I hear a week after that, it's going to go even lower to, I believe, 16 plus.
16 plus, yeah. So it's really going to be, it's going to be something.
At the towards the first week of April.
So. More good news, Amtrak is restoring their daily long-distance train service next month because of the federal relief funds that they just got. So that means daily cross-country trips instead of once every 3 days or whatever it's been. And finally, Volkswagen is going to be changing its name in the United States to Volkswagen with a T instead of a K. It's not April Fool's. They're really doing this because they're pushing the electric cars, Volkswagen. I don't know. I feel more German when I'm saying it, you know? Like, but it still feels wrong somehow.
Yeah. There's all kinds of pronunciations. I think sometimes people pronounce the W's as V's and vice versa. And suffice to say, there's a lot behind this push. They've created multiple new platforms. They've had basically given up on clean diesel after the Dieselgate incident, and have put a lot of emphasis in the future of electric.
Well, they officially, according to the Associated Press, this is because their production is increasingly moving towards electric vehicles, but they're trying to distance themselves from that emissions cheating scandal. Do you really think people are going to say, oh, Volkswagen, they've got nothing to do with emissions. Volkswagen, on the other hand, did. I don't think it's going to work quite that way, but it's cute. I'll give them that. It's cute.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the old name or just the initials are still going to reign as far as brand identity. But I don't know. VW is very savvy with branding and commercials, and this is a serious arena of competition for them. So they're really excited about it, and will no doubt have more tricks up their sleeves.
Yes, you heard it right. Our weekly feature has begun. Films of the Year That Was, where Kyle and I take a look at an Academy Award winning film year by year. And last year we looked at was 1995, and the film Braveheart with Mel Gibson. Gotta say, I wasn't looking forward to that all that much. I'm really not a Mel Gibson fan, but the film was okay. It's kind of it's about the liberation of Scotland, but oh boy, so many historical inaccuracies. If you look at IMDb, just all the under the goofs section, it's longer than any film I've ever seen. And, you know, they knew they were getting it wrong. For instance, they didn't wear kilts in the 1300s, there's that. Scotland had only been taken over by England 1 year before all the action began. They made it seem like it was a longer time. It's an entertaining film. It is, you know, but it's Hollywood. You can't forget that. What do you think, Kyle?
Yeah, I'm with you. It was definitely a gross exaggeration of the history, very much to fit a romantic narrative and a hero story to a degree, to a large degree, that they wanted to convey, with complete disregard for how actually history really went. It was written by... Randall Wallace, and directed by Mel Gibson, Alan Ladd, and Bruce Davey.
I should point out that he's not related to William Wallace, which is who the film was about, who Mel Gibson plays. So just to clear that up. He went over to Scotland to find his roots, apparently, and discovered the story of William Wallace and discovered that he wasn't related to him in any way. But he decided to write the story and make a film out of it. So, yeah, okay, you did that, but it's not historically accurate. Anybody in Scotland would tell you that. In fact, the person who, that Bruce guy, what was his name? I don't have it in front of me, but his name is Bruce. He's the real hero of Scotland. And he was portrayed as
Robert
somebody,
the Bruce.
Robert the Bruce, okay. Robert the Bruce. Okay, he was portrayed as somebody who stabbed William Wallace in the back. and wasn't a hero at all. I'm not sure why you would do that. And in fact, William Wallace, Mel Gibson, was not Braveheart. It was the Bruce guy who was Braveheart in real life.
That's
so,
right.
So things like that really, you know, bug people in Scotland a bit.
And they're making this whole world, and you're supposed to sort of derive that, even though this person comes off as a minor character, and we see much more of Mel Gibson's character in William Wallace, opposed to Robert the Bruce.
Robert the Scott, or Robert the Scott? Robert the Bruce. Which is it? It's Robert the Bruce.
Bruce, the Bruce clan.
The Bruce clan, okay.
Scottish. Yeah.
Scottish, right. That's okay. So Robert the Bruce was part of a noble family, and that entitled them to the throne of Scotland, whereas William Wallace was a commoner. Well, in real life, William Wallace was also a nobleman, or came from a noble family. Not the richest, but still somebody with privilege.
But minor incongruences like that just make it, it just seems less like a subtle exaggeration, and much more like a complete generous fabrication.
Right, right. You know, one thing, the King of England, this guy Longshanks, what they call King Edward Longshanks, they called him that because he was tall, but Braveheart was taller. And back then, people weren't 6 feet tall, apparently, so that was unusual. But he was played by Patrick McGoohan, who you might know from The Prisoner. I didn't even know that was him. I have to see it again just to see him speak and realize who that is. But there was one thing in the film which really bugged me, and that was the way his son was portrayed. Because his son was obviously gay, but the film made it seem like that made him completely incompetent and cowardly and a ridiculous character. You know, it just, I could see audiences back then laughing at this, but it really, it stood out as something that, first of all, again, doesn't reflect history at all, but was unnecessary. It was this bit of humor at the expense of a particular type of person. Just really, it was distracting. It really was distracting. And they could have told the story better without that, I think.
Yeah, and oddly enough, Game of Thrones had the same through line. Like, this, like, fairy who was inadequate and never enough. It was, like, the same treatment, pretty much. Even though there were other strong characters that were mildly queer in that story. But it's changed, but also not changed very much.
Which character was that? I'm trying to remember. And we're going to have a hard time because I don't remember any
different
of the names.
Different story, different world.
I thought they portrayed gay characters in Game of Thrones fairly well. But maybe they missed the ball in a few.
It's a fleeting comparison, right. But I'm not so sure things have changed entirely. I mean, you know where that comes from. It comes from stereotypes, and there are a lot of strong characters in a lot of contemporary storytelling now that are both queer and strong and or, you know, not completely inept as a result of being queer, in other words.
I know that there was one scene where the king, Longshanks, threw his son's boyfriend out the window to his death. And that was kind of presented as a humorous scene. Think about that. I like to think we've changed. I like to think that today a filmmaker would think twice before making something like that historically inaccurate and apparently for the sake of humor.
But a lot of that is to project and amplify the mores and taboos around masculinity and types of persons. And at the time, there just was not a lot of lanes for that. You were either, a knight or a maiden or a witch or something.
It was also, you know, Mel Gibson. You know, you got to keep that. You know, that's a pretty narrow lane to be traveling down.
Same applies.
Yeah.
In fact, more so.
So there was also this this law. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly. Jus Primae Noctis, which allows the lord of a medieval estate to take the virginity of his serf's maiden daughters on their wedding nights. So in other words, you get married, and the lord of the manor takes your wife on your wedding night and basically rapes her. Okay, it's a horrible thing. It's what spurred this whole revolution or uprising. Only thing is, it didn't exist. It wasn't real. There's no record of that ever happening in England, in Scotland. Not to say atrocities have not happened, but this was just made up for the film, apparently.
Yeah, it's like something that's become a popular like myth or a popular conception of in various forms, but there is really not a lot of evidence in historical analysis that supports it in any way, but it is still has its manifestations in war making and conquest, and it can be a metaphor for forms of conquest and in sexual conquest, and of course subjugation, which is a big part of medieval society and the society they're depicting in Braveheart. So this serves to really amplify the sense that leadership or taking over of the territory was much longer and more oppressive and torturous and onerous than perhaps it was in who was taking over power at any one time. So it really exaggerates the nature of the oppressing regime.
Well, the film ends, I think, in around 13-14 or so. And that's when Robert the Bruce survives after William Wallace is executed and leads another rebellion against the English, winning them, that's how the film ends, winning the Scots their freedom. What they don't mention is that only lasted a few years before the whole thing happened all over again. It was a second war of independence. And you know what? Scotland is still part of England right now, or attached to England in ways they don't want to be attached. Most people, I think, over there. So I'm hoping that they, without all the violence and craziness of Braveheart, I hope maybe a referendum or something, they get their independence and rejoin the EU. That's my hope.
Isn't it interesting that for all the inaccuracy, there is this sentiment that endures today?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
In this being Scottish. So we'll, of course, report on that fun story, and we're on to the next year, 96, I believe.
No, we didn't see our foreign film from 1995 yet. We still have to do that. There's a foreign winner for
I wasn't talking about
Academy
that
Award.
Category. Clearly, the audience was listening closely and uh-huh. knew that I specifically was talking about the best picture, domestic right. best picture.
Well, we have to see the 1995's foreign film.
I appreciate
first.
You reminding me about
Of course, that. That's what I'm here for.
So appreciate it.
Let me also remind our listeners that they can call 631-632-6901 and pledge any amount that they feel is appropriate to keep WUSB on the air, or they can go to tinyurl.com/helpWUSB and pledge directly and keep this amazing radio station going, because that's what allows us to do this once a week. And if you like what we do once a week or don't like what we do once a week, you can tell us by writing to us, otw@2600.com.
Until next time.
Yes, we're signing off now because our hour is over. Finn is coming up next. Until next time, this is Emmanuel.
And I've been Kyle.
You have, and you will continue to be Kyle, and you'll be Kyle next week. And we're going to go out with what is the unofficial national anthem of Scotland, since they're not yet an independent nation, but they will be soon. This is called the Flower of Scotland. Enjoy.